Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Thank you, Jed. It's a real pleasure to be here to introduce Dr. Elaine Storkey, who, among many things, is a very old friend of mine. We've known each other for probably over 25 years. It's a particular personal pleasure for me to introduce her. The Kirkland Institute for Christian Ethics is delighted also to be a sponsoring organisation for this first Veritas Forum held in Cambridge. And we got off to a great start last night with Baroness Cox. I know we're in for a treat in the next hour or so. So as I say, I've known Elaine for many years, and I've learned a great deal from her. I could spend the next hour telling you what I've learned from her, but just mention one thing, which is the way that over many years, in many settings, diverse settings with pluralistic audiences, she's been able to model a winsome way of conveying the Christian faith in a challenging way, in a direct way, with great honesty and insight, and I'm sure we're going to look forward to seeing that on display in the next hour. Sorry to raise the stakes so high, Elaine. Elaine currently is the president of Tier Fund. She's also the vice president of the University of Gloucestershire. She's taught theology and sociology at, among other places, King's College London, Birkbeck College at the University of London, and at Oxford University. She's the author of, I think, at least 8 books and contributed to many, many more. She's a regular media communicator, including on the BBC. She's lectured widely all across the world, partly recently in her role as president of Tier Fund. She just returned recently from a trip in Haiti, where she was leading a seminar on Christian leaders who are beginning to catch on to the vision of making a difference in a society like Haiti with all its difficulties and challenges. Please welcome Dr. Elaine Storkey.
Thanks, it's lovely to be here. Can you hear me if I speak like this? That's great. In the Assembly Hall of the General Synod of the Church of England, where I was just a few weeks ago, a visiting woman in the balcony screamed down to the Archbishop of Canterbury, "No Sharia law, no gay marriages, resign, you Druid." She was politely but firmly escorted out of the chamber. Although she was uninvited and she wasn't called by the chair to speak, she was, of course, at one level, perfectly in order. She was exercising her constitutional rights in a pluralist democracy to protest against pluralism. Her reasons, unfortunately, remained undisclosed. Whether her protest was as a Christian, a Jew, a Hindu, a secularist, or as someone who simply just doesn't like the Welsh, she wasn't investigated. Nobody ran to ask her. Nobody wanted her to develop her arguments or agonized over her outburst. We just waited until she got moved out of the chamber and then carried on with business as usual. Pluralism is very often linked with democracy. And indeed, it's probably only in some form of democracy that pluralism can survive. State autocracy, totalitarianism, despotic rule, none of these provide a fertile ground for the seeding and growth of pluralism. Most secularists applaud pluralism as a much-needed bulwark against fundamentalism. Many people of faith exhibit anxiety about pluralism, fearing that it might be prohibitive or restrictive in its relationship to the expression of belief. This is not, of course, the position held by either of the Anglican archbishops. In a letter just today in The Guardian, questioning proposed changes to the blasphemy law, the archbishops of Canterbury and York see no dissonance between a pluralist society and a Christian faith. And they write something like this. The place of Christianity, this is a letter to the government, The place of Christianity in the constitutional framework of our country, governed as it is by the Queen, in Parliament, under God, is not in question in the current debate. That's the debate on the blasphemy laws. The relationship between church and state, reaffirmed by the government last July in the governance of Britain, will continue to provide a context in which people of all faiths and none can live together in mutual respect in this part of the realm. Now they're making curious, if you like, claims there that we can have a pluralist democracy, but at the same time we can have a special place for Christianity in the constitutional framework of that democracy. And as they're saying, that's not actually up for grabs, even if you were to change the blasphemy law. And there were some key assumptions embedded in that letter to the government, which you might want to examine and which we might tease out later. So, of course, all of this begs the question of what it means for something to be a pluralist society. And pluralism has been variously defined. There's no just simple one definition. This is Umberto Eco writing in 2001. We're a pluralist civilization, he says, because we allow mosques to be built in our countries. And we're not going to stop simply because Christian missionaries are thrown into prison in Kabul. If we did so, we too would become Taliban. The parameter of tolerating diversity is certainly one of the strongest and least open to argument. We consider our culture mature because it can tolerate diversity. And those who share our culture whilst rejecting diversity to be uncivilized. Period. We hope that if we allow mosques in our countries, one day there will be Christian churches in their countries. I think this is a fascinating argument. Basically, the argument is that pluralism is not a contractual tit-for-tat arrangement based on reciprocation by other cultures. In fact, it exists irrespective of whether or not other cultures take up the same argument or the same operation. Pluralism is something that tolerates diversity, especially religious diversity, because this is the mature, the right, the better thing to do, in the hope that such toleration will be catching. Now, a more postmodern view about pluralism is expressed in an article on the Lebanon by Alex Klaushofer in The Guardian just last week. And this is what he argues. He argues that beneath all the media coverage of Lebanon's problems is a society which is tolerant and accepting. So he holds Lebanon up as a kind of role model, as an example of what we could all be like if we were a proper pluralist society, a proper accepting society, and a proper tolerant society. And this is what he says. What struck me most was a tolerance which respects the faith positions of others on a deep level, a sort of you have your God and I have mine attitude, based on a shared understanding of what it means to have a faith. It's a religious culture that generates little need for people to shout about who's right or whose faith is superior. Of course, that presupposes that all the arguments are about superiority of faith, which, of course, they're not. There are many, many arguments built into the way in which faiths discuss and debate and dialogue with one another. And the attitude of superiority is not usually, in my own opinion and my own experience, one that features very highly. But this isn't an unusual view of faith in our contemporary world. In fact, it's one regularly appealed to by people who want to avoid discussion or argument. Well, you have your faith and I have mine. I'm very glad that you found a faith, really happy for you. It's got no interest whatsoever to me. I'll just carry on in my normal life. It's business as usual as far as I'm concerned. And it's often the recipe for a privatization of faith, where faith becomes a matter of individual belief rather than having any public, legal, or institutional implications. In fact, it's the wonderful cop-out. Now, I'm not suggesting it's like that in the Lebanon. I think it's much more sophisticated and much more peaceful from what he's saying. But to hold this up as a way forward, I think, is seriously lacking. Yet another understanding of faith and pluralism is offered by the education director of the Hindu Council of the United Kingdom. And he wrote this last November, pointing out that one of the greatest challenges we face in this country is how to diffuse strife caused by people in the name of religion. Continuing to shield exclusivist agendas, he says, is no way forward. So what's the solution? And this is his solution. The solution lies in an innocuous-sounding word, pluralism. In a nutshell, and the underlining is mine, this is an acceptance that there can be many pathways for making spiritual progress. It can be made in theistic mode, a non-theistic mode, even in a non-religious mode. We're all different, and this difference shows up in the way we relate to ideas of spirituality. Now, in this comment, you'll notice that pluralism is not just a process, it's not just a way of tolerating it, it's not just a plea for acceptance, but it now embodies a view of truth, the view that there can be many pathways for making spiritual progress. And that's a very different and a much more ontological view, if you like, of pluralism than what we've seen so far. He goes on to elucidate this. Down the centuries, he says, different prophets have promoted different pathways for spiritual progress, tailored to suit the needs of the society they inhabited. Over time, these teachings ossified as various religions. Every religion can be seen as a particular pathway promoted to suit the needs of the time. The destination they promise may be glorified as absolute, but pathways can certainly not be absolute. They're always relative because they have to relate to us. And again, you see a very strong undergirding of the idea of pluralism with a worldview, a view of truth, a view of life, a view of religion, almost a kind of historicism where things are mapped out in relation to a particular time and era, a particular society or societal structure. And then he goes on, nevertheless, to insist that this isn't a relativistic position, that it's not a relativist view. It's, in fact, simply a view that sees a diversity of prescription adopted by different groups as they reflect different starting points. But the prescriptions, he insists, are binding in each case. So this isn't relativism, according to this particular author, because the prescriptions are binding within each particular expression of faith. Nevertheless, each expression of faith has been relativized with regard to time and culture and what works in a particular society. So he has already relativized those starting points. He's already robbed them of any universal or abiding nature. And this is one of the frequent claims, frequent positions, really for almost all relativist claims. Something to do with a universal claim is built into the relativism itself. And to reinforce his own position, he says, I think rather alarmingly, one casualty of pluralism will be the proselytizing agendas of missionary religions. In other words, the argument is that a truly plural society, a truly pluralist society, wouldn't be one where evangelism and missionary religion was given space to flourish, because no truth claims can be allowed, and they can't even be allowed, it seems, to compete in the marketplace. We have to recognize that there are many different paths, and those different paths must be allowed to be different, and we mustn't be open to the persuasion of one group over another. And this is a view of pluralism that begins to make it sound much less tolerant and much less genuinely pluralist than that of Umberto Eco. It's also, of course, and this is the sting in the tail, a view which itself is heavily reliant on a worldview. It's not a view that sees everything as equal, that accepts all religions as perfectly normal and equal starting points for the spiritual journey. Embedded in it is a Hindu perspective which informs and directs the whole way in which now pluralism is seen within that context. So the view of faith and pluralism, this view particularly, and the one that we saw before, offers very little resistance to a contemporary secular agenda. As Professor Grayling, A.C. Grayling, Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck College, argues, he wants to see a pluralism that does banish effectively some of the most fundamentalist disputes in religion. I'd like to see, he says, conservatives and fundamentalists in all religion accept the principles of pluralism and secularism. So he's asking quite a lot of us, really. Not only that we accept principles of pluralism, but principles of pluralism now somehow become synonymous with secularism. By the latter, meaning a situation in which religious observance is a private matter, a private affair, wholly separated from the public and political domains. If this were to happen, he suggests, a great amount of conflict would vanish from the world. I love the optimism of secularists. It's based on virtually nothing, as far as I can see, since some of the most repressive and harsh regimes of the world have been secularist regimes, ones that have stepped out to banish religion in a profound way. In fact, a history of secularism does not give us much encouragement in terms of coming to terms with some of this. He goes on to say this. He sees fundamentalist believers as those who impose their own particular visions on everyone else, sometimes by violent means, always by means of censorship and ideas and free speech, thus threatening to the reverse the progress in liberty and enlightenment which has been central to the history of the modern Western world. So there again we get this polemic, we get this polarisation between the well-meaning, enlightened, free, accommodating and tolerant secularist, on the other hand, the harsh believer who operates with violence and censorship in order to threaten free speech and allow people to express their own free ideas. In fact, this is counter to what I think isn't there really in the history of the Enlightenment, which is central, as he says, to the history of the modern world. Much Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment thinking didn't have this tolerance about it. In fact, if you were to look at the middle of the last century, some of the most profound secularist thinkers, some in this own university and some in Oxford too, who are expressing their version of secularism and secularism and free thinking, it sounded like anything but open and free and liberty, full of liberty and enlightenment. In fact, if you look at even the works of A.J. Eyre, a professor of philosophy in London, where he's insisting that all meaning, in order for anything to be described as meaningful, it has to have a truth value. And therefore we have to examine every statement that's made, not just for its truth, whether it can be assigned a value of truth or falsity, but also for its meaningfulness. If it cannot be assigned a value of truth or falsity, then it's ipso facto a meaningless statement and may not be uttered. And from this very bold claim, he goes on to insist, in just a few paragraphs later, that it's therefore impossible for a person to be a believer, to be an atheist, or to be an agnostic, because each of these positions presuppose there is something meaningful about the nature of belief. But actually, the nature of belief cannot be expressed in statements or propositions to which they can be assigned a truth value. So they cannot be given truth or falsity, and therefore they're not meaningful. Therefore, people who embody these, or even enter into a dialogue with them, an atheist is just as meaningless as a believer, then in a very real sense, we just banish this whole discourse from our language and from our culture. That's barely tolerant and barely open to the different views that secularists produce. And, of course, secularism itself has moved on from there, but we have to remember that a great deal of its history has been intent on banishing the discourse of any form of religion from the public arena. A.C. Grayling wants to say the opposite. Secularism is not against religion, he insists. It's about having a neutral public domain, about allowing different points of view to have their place in the sun without privileging any one of them. I find it utterly, utterly amazing how a professor of philosophy at one of our leading universities can be so totally unself-conscious than to not recognise what he is doing is privileging the secularist position. Of course this is privileging one of them, privileging the position he himself holds. And what goes along with that privileging is the pushing of all other views out of the public arena. What's very evident from the comments of the National Secular Society is that secularism is perfectly comfortable and content these days with a privatised faith. It doesn't matter and doesn't mind if Christians worship in churches, as long as it's preferably done, of course, by consenting adults in private. Sacred language, sacred liturgy is fine too. It serves us well, as long as it becomes part of the museum culture. But the moment belief is allowed to intrude into the normal public area of life, into the dialogue about communities, about family life, about the economy, about politics, about social welfare, about neighbourhoods, about anything that actually has substance and connects with people's normal lives, then it must be banished as dangerous. For faith, then, to occupy any public place is not permissible from a secularist point of view. Jim Skillen from the Association of Public Justice in the United States in Washington feels that this is relevant exactly to the situation of America today, referring to the resistance of secularists and atheists towards religion, and particularly towards the expression of religion in the public arena. This is what he says. These atheists with attitude wouldn't be horribly offended by American political God talk, because even the most personally religious candidates want to uphold America's political secularity. The American civil religion works, in other words, as long as candidates and public officials speak only in personal terms about their private, so-called sectarian faith. In other words, faith is allowed at the margins. Faith is allowed as a perfect personal expression of one's own identity, one's own view of things. But where it's not allowed is actually intruding into public policy, into issues of justice, into issues of war, into issues of national security or international relationships. Then it becomes dangerous. And of course, one has to raise big questions about those whole areas. It's unselfconscious, again, in its own religious character. And what Skillen goes on to say is this. What's missing from the candidates' professions of Christian and Mormon faith is a philosophy of the political community that clarifies the responsibility of government in relation to the responsibilities that belong to all other institutions, organizations, relationships of human society. What we need is a Christian public philosophy that connects directly to office holding, to policy formation, and to governing. Americanism and the liberal political tradition don't generate such a philosophy, and that's why we have what we have. Now, this is sounding as if we're moving away from a kind of pluralism. It sounds like almost on the surface is an attack on pluralism from faith, because this is the dichotomy that we've been used to hearing. We're either pluralist, neutral, there in the public arena, allowing a secular agenda to dominate, or we're intruding with a faith perspective. And yet the way to resolve deep religious disputes can't be, or any other disputes, can't be to privilege secularism whilst pushing other views out of the public arena, but rather to assure all religions equal access to the public square, regardless of their majority or minority status. In a pluralistic society, organized under a constitutionally limited government, the argument for the equal treatment of religion can be understood as an extension of the argument for justice for all or equal treatment under the law. I put that there. And so it's the whole idea is that secularism is not going to solve the problems of religious dispute, because it's got its own religious worldview, a worldview based on the faith that there is no God. I was asked by a programme on the BBC if I would come and, I can't remember the actual content of the programme, but come and speak on a particular side of the debate. And I said I would, but I first of all had to do another programme an hour earlier, and so could we rearrange the time? And the person asking me was intrigued as to what the programme was doing. And I mentioned it was a programme for religious broadcasting, and we were looking at the nature of faith in contemporary Britain. And she kind of laughed and said, oh, are they still making programmes like that? How extraordinary. She said, that's very odd. I didn't realise that was still going on in the BBC. And I assured her not only was it going on, but going on at a regular motif and so on. And she said, that's very odd. So I said, why is it odd? What's your position? Oh, I don't have a position, she said. I'm just normal. I just don't believe that God exists. So not to have a position is to be normal and to believe that God does not exist, and therefore to enter into a discussion, but that is a position. And not only is it a position, it's a position that will affect the way that you do the broadcast that we're about to do. It will affect the parameters of the program that you're about to make. It will affect the way that you understand my contribution to the program. And actually, I'm not sure that I want to come and participate, because it doesn't sound as if this is going to be equal territory in the public square. We had a very interesting discussion and I did participate, but it's very hard shifting that worldview, shifting that block mentality that to be normal was to be secularist, was to have no faith, was to be pluralist, and to be Christian was to be deviant, in some sense pushing against the neutrality of the normal era. By contrast then, references to the God of public life must be made in all-inclusive terms. And I think there's so much here that we need to look at in terms of equal treatment under the law. I want to say, let's move on very quickly to a different view of pluralism, which I think is one that I always want to encourage you to discuss and to develop at much greater detail than I'm going to do this afternoon. I think we need something different from what we're hearing, both from the new atheists and from the presidential candidates in the United States. I think it's appropriate to have some very serious public talk about the transcendent creator of heaven and earth, the judge of all nations, because it is God's mercy that is upholding the demands of justice, which make it possible for an open society and make possible the equal treatment of all faiths. I think that particularly both atheists and civil religionists are often missing the boat because they don't understand the part that faith plays in the public arena and also in the construction of a healthy pluralism. So I'd want to say that there are two fundamental pluralist principles, and these pluralist principles themselves, when we look and examine them, are actually closely identified and closely based on a faith perspective. The first pluralist diversity principle is the wide range of human responsibilities and social institutions. And the first principle, therefore, is that the laws of the land should acknowledge and do justice to this societal diversity by upholding an open, non-totalitarian and pluralist social contract. Pluralist social order. What does all this mean? This is sometimes called horizontal pluralism. And basically what it's saying is that society is made up of God-ordained institutions. You can drop the God-ordained out and you can just leave institutions, or you can put it in. And in a sense, the fact that you have that choice means that the pluralism can be open both to that kind of interpretation and to an interpretation that eliminates God from the picture. So society is made up of God-ordained institutions like marriage, family, church, religion, education, business, arts, science, and a thousand other ones that we could think of, economic, political institutions and so on, each of which reflect different areas of life. And faith, that is supposed to be kept private, therefore does not have anything to say in these particular areas. But education, the arts and business have to be opened up and respected within a pluralist institution and within a pluralist society. And in fact, in reality, all institutions are part of the general purposes of God from a faith position. The family has all kinds of options as to how it lives, how it conducts its family life, how it nurtures its young, how it cares for the children, how it respects its elderly, what it does with aged parents and so on. And much of these are embedded within pluralist principles. We have within a pluralist society rules about family conduct. We have rules as to what you may or may not do with your children. We have rules as to how you may treat or may not treat the elderly and so on. And where do these rules come from? And in a mature pluralism, they take great note of faith perspectives of the country, of the society, because they feed into these in a thorough way. Social authority, then, is and should be distributed widely across a range of social institutions. Institutional authorities are mutually and simultaneously delimiting. And so part of our pluralism, this first horizontal pluralism, this diversity of human institutions, is that each institution should be given its space to flourish. that the economic institution shouldn't dictate to the family, shouldn't dominate the family, so that both parents are working all hours that God sends and nobody is bringing up the children. That is not a healthy pluralist society. A more healthy society is one that respects the parents' need to be at home, respects that children have to be nurtured and brought up in principles, and respects that the economy should not gobble up every other institution. So the economy should not be dictating to the family or to the educational system or to the state or to even to the union or to the community, but should have its own place, its own limited place in the structure of the whole. British law already recognises much of this, that many non-state bodies have a part to play in understanding the structure of institutions. And we have to recognise that that's also true. The other part of pluralism that we need to look at, the other diversity, is the variety of faiths and philosophies by which people direct their public and private lives. And so the second pluralist principle requires that the laws of the land do justice to these faiths and philosophies by means of their equitable and non-discriminatory treatment in public as well as in the private spheres of life. We need a political system that recognises that worldviews and perspectives operate in all different areas of life. And so there has to be common law that unites us, but there also has to be space for people to live according to their beliefs, according to their deep convictions as to how they should live their lives, whom they should worship, whom they should serve. And this is, again, something very fundamental to Christianity. And it's, you could almost say that this kind of pluralism is based on a prior understanding of the persons and the community's walk before God. Because in both the Old and New Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures and the Gospels, God is constantly presenting people with the choice. Choose this day whom you will serve. Choose this day. And therefore, we cannot take away that choice from people or communities. But since God has given it to them, we have to honour it in the laws of our land. It doesn't mean to say that God will not hold people accountable for wrong choices, or for the ways that they have actually betrayed the choices they made, or for the ways that they have turned their backs on God's offer to them of relationship and so on. But this is between God and those people. It's not between God and the law of the land and those people. The law cannot intervene. The state cannot control. The state cannot regulate. The state cannot schedule people to respond to God in specific ways. It must leave them with the option that is open. A strict separationist policy, then, cannot do justice to either of these principles of pluralism. And it has to be opened up and recognised that only when you have a pluralism that's already based on a worldview that itself respects the reality and the truth of the existence of God and God's dealings with his humankind, that we can find that this gives us the scope for building a proper pluralist society. The question then about Christianity and politics, Christianity and pluralism, faith and a pluralist society, is very profound. As the question about the relation of political power to any set of deep convictions people may hold is also profound. The question for me, as a practicing Christian, is whether Christianity from its deepest roots drives towards public justice for all citizens, or to whether it itself privileges a certain kind of public arena. Whether the concept of Christian Britain, which is part of a bigger picture of Christendom, means that we don't allow equal space, we don't allow freedom for other religions in the way that we are currently arguing for. I think the place to start, then, is the Christian scriptures, because there's no evidence in the Bible that Jesus Christ and his apostles called on governments to impose Christianity on the public at large. There's no evidence that he urged Christians to use political power to gain privileges for themselves. Jesus recognized the legitimacy of governments. He spoke of God as the one who sends the rain and the sunshine on the just and on the unjust. He told his disciples it wasn't their responsibility to separate believers from unbelievers. And so many of his parables, the wheat and the tares, the fish in the net, the sower sowing his seed, are about the fact that we don't know, and it's not for us to judge who is right in a right relationship with God and who is in a wrong relationship with God. But we have to make the facilities possible for people to hear the word of God and the voice of God and to respond. Paul urged Christians to recognize and to submit to governments as ministers appointed by God to encourage those who do good and punish those who do wrong. And he admonished fellow believers to live at peace with everyone insofar as it depends on them. And both Old and New Testaments speak of the accountability of governments to God directly, not via submission to the church. That is why any institution that actually doesn't operate in this kind of pluralist way, but directs government through church or through some religious institution or organization, is already violating some of the fundamental principles that Christianity holds dear. It says then, Israel had its own government, of course, and those in power were repeatedly called to account for not doing justice to the people, and not even to the aliens within. The Psalms, the prophets, the wisdom literature all focus attention on the government's obligation to do justice for all. And it's a powerful rhetoric that continues right through the prophets, railing constantly at the failure of the people to do justice, at the failure of the rulers to do justice, but the showing partiality, using dishonest scales, wrong methods, choosing favourites, accepting bribes, all of these things was actually turning their back on the fundamental call to justice. So then a phrase like Christian democracy or Christian pluralism or a pluralist society following from a Christian principle base shouldn't be an oxymoron. In fact, Christianity, I would argue, properly understood, is the very fount of an open society offering equal treatment to people of all faiths, offering political participation, offering representation for all citizens, offering strong protection against the abuse of power by government, offering visions to protect the right of non-government organisations and institutions on an equal treatment basis. Where do we start? And I just want to rush to the end of my talk, otherwise I'll go on forever. I think we, from a Christian point of view, ultimately we have to start with where our Christian faith probably takes the strongest and most different diversion from any other faith, and that is to start with the cross itself. I think I might have, because this is a quotation from N.T. Wright, and I think it's a very fine quotation. The cross, he says, will not let the fundamentalists corrupt the message into self-serving power, just as it will not let the secularists get away with the standard critique of dangerous religion. The cross is at the heart of a redefinition of the word God, a redefinition itself which will open up new possibilities for what it might mean to think of God in public. What are those possibilities that it opens up? Well, it opens up the possibilities of servanthood, of servant rule, of servant leadership. It opens up the possibilities of loving your neighbour as yourself, of serving your neighbour and seeking the very best for your neighbour, of wanting fairness and justice for your neighbour, of wanting mercy for your neighbour. Again, so many parables that Jesus offers are about the way in which God tempers justice with mercy. What else does the cross offer up to us? It offers up a dimension of the whole of life, of new possibilities for justice, a deep respect for others, as well as a recognition that the harm we do and the evil we do lives on long after us and actually affects other people in the way in which they live their lives, in the way in which they grow old, in the way in which they move on through their own environment. The cross opens up the protection of the vulnerable, a care for community, the need for fair transactions. It shows the hollowness and the shallowness of injustice and the deceitfulness and the hypocrisy that pursues Christ to the cross. Most of all, the cross shows us that at the very heart of God's self, there is mercy and love, and an acceptance and a call, a constant call, come this day, choose this day whom you will serve. Look, I give my life for you. Choose this day whom you will serve. A pluralist society at its very best allows faith to flourish, allows every aspect of faith to find our meaning, to find fruition, and to be voiced coherently. A pluralist society does not stop us from contending with those faiths in the marketplace. It does not stop proselytization. It does not stop evangelism. It does not stop the public proclamation of the Christian gospel and arguing with people of all faiths in a coherent, gentle, constructive, and open manner. What it does stop is violence and rhetoric and power-seeking and refusal to recognize and respect the other and to seek the well-being of their walk with God. At the end of the day, the understanding of who we are is one that we share as a total humanity. We are who we are. We are in searching for our own identity. We are searching for meaning, for love. We're searching for safety in our communities. We're looking for a society that we can respect and that respects us, where there isn't deceit, where there isn't partiality, where there isn't injustice, where people are not penalised for who they are, for what they believe, but people are allowed to flourish and grow and express themselves so long as that expression doesn't annihilate or negate another person. And this is a good society to live in. Whether or not it's a salvific society is a very different issue, because society is not offering us salvation. Only God offers us salvation. And salvation can only be obtained when we bow the knee and recognize the call of God and respond accordingly. But what society has to do is to allow us to grow in such a way that all our institutions can be opened up constructively and fully and have a proper place in society, and where our beliefs can be expressed and where we have the space to hunt and search until we know that God has found us.
Delivered with precision, brevity, and insight. We have about 25 minutes for discussion to allow time for the turnaround for the next session. We don't have a roving mic, so if you have a question, please raise your hand, stand up, say who you are, if you like, direct your question to Elaine, and then I'm going to ask Elaine to repeat the question for purposes of recording. So, the floor is open. Who would like to raise the opening question? Or comment, or suggestion?
Okay. I'm Gabriel. Hello. I wanted to ask about the quote you gave from Jay McCartney. About the idea of different paths to spiritual progress, and that being from understanding of a way of describing religious pluralism. And I was thinking back to a talk I went to given by Rowan Williams about a week ago. And he was asked a question about the classic question of if you have to be a Christian to achieve salvation, or something like that. And he said, that he didn't really know, but he could say that he believed it was through Christianity that you understood most fully what God was, and how you came most fully into an understanding of God. And to me, that kind of allows for a different range of ways of achieving spiritual progress, you know, not just through Christianity, perhaps through Christianity most fully, in Dr. Williams' view, but also through lots of other different faiths and religions as well, and spiritual guidance and divine guidance to be found in lots of different places. And I just wondered in what way you felt that. I described Mithani's idea as being sort of very Hindu in its outlook. And I wondered if you felt how that kind of contrasted to what Dr. Williams said about understanding coming fully into God.
Thank you. The question was really about a quotation from the Jewish educational advisor, the Hindu educational advisor, and comparing this with an answer that Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, gave last week to a question about salvation. Whether salvation was only really through the Christian faith or through Christ. And he pointed out that there were, I can't remember exactly what you said in terms of his answer, but implied that there were many routes to God, and that in a sense, although Christianity expressed this most fully and invited people in most fully, there may be other ways in which people could enter into a proper and deeper relationship, which had a different route. So I suppose you're asking me to comment on that. I think traditionally there have been three positions with regard to what we mean by faith and salvation. There is the exclusivist position, which is really the kind of position that most of the secularists are upset mostly about, because each of these positions argues that only the truth can only be understood from where I'm now standing. And so it goes. The argument goes something like this: accept what I'm saying, believe what I say, or else you're a heretic. And that's actually very uncomfortable if you're on the other side of that position, because there's hardly any leeway. So the exclusivist position, at its hardness, is a fundamentalist position. It says, for any religion, whether it's Catholicism, that you can only be a true Christian if you're a member of the Catholic Church, or whether it's any form of Islam that's arguing it's only through the Islamic faith, in the sense that you understand the full meaning of Allah and the full will of God, or evangelical Christianity. Now, the exclusivist position is both right and wrong as far as I'm concerned. The very heart of the Christian faith is an exclusivism, in the sense that it's probably the only faith that claims that God was incarnate in a particular person, and claims, therefore, uniqueness for that person. And so the whole uniqueness of Christ as the Son of God, but also the Saviour of humankind, isn't mirrored and isn't replicated in any other religion. No other religion makes that kind of claim. And that's what makes Christianity rather uneven, if you like, in terms of its relationship with the other religious groups. So then what does one do with that exclusive claim for the uniqueness of Christ? And the exclusivist would say, as you said, that it is only by coming and accepting formally that Christ died for you, and putting your life in the hands of Christ, that you can know salvation. That's the exclusivist position then. The inclusivist position would say something slightly different. It would say that from a Christian point of view, if you wanted to look at inclusivist Christianity or inclusivist Christian position, he would say there is something absolutely total about the uniqueness of Christ. The Christ is not replicated in any other religion. There is no other claim, as far as I can see, throughout the whole universe of religions, that there is another incarnate Son of God. But in order to enter into salvation with God, or into the relationship which is a saving relationship, you don't necessarily need to know personally or have to come personally and to have made your own personal commitment. So the inclusivists would say that there are many people who will find God who yet have not understood the claims of Christ or entered into the relationship with Christ and so on. But insofar as they have, insofar as they have understood what God is saying in the culture through their own religion, they will have some relationship also with God that one has to respect and admit is a fruitful and dynamic relationship. The big question, then, what is left for the place of Christ? And the inclusivists would say, and this is where the arrogance of the faith claim, of course, hits people, that even though Hindus will come to God, and even though Buddhists and Muslims and Jews, ultimately it is still through the work of Christ on the cross. It is still through the saving grace of Christ, manifest in many different ways that we don't understand, that is still operating as the avenue and the path. This is what John St. Luke said last week in Great St. Mary's, that it's like going over Magdalen Bridge in the fog. You don't necessarily know that you're going over the bridge. You don't know it because the fog, you can't see very clearly. But what you can see makes you assured that this is a good way to go. And that's Christ as the bridge, if you like, even the bridge that is there, that is true of many other religious groups. Is an inclusivist position. The third one is just a relativist position, to say there is no one way to God, which I think this comes fairly close to, and this is why I'd objected to it. But everybody finds their own way to God, and that's perfectly permissible. And I think relativism is... at worst, of course, it's misleading and it's unhelpful, but it's also a very difficult position to articulate. Because most relativists are speaking with universal intent, even though they're arguing that it's only a relativist position. And that's one of the confusions, I think, of it. Maybe you want to come back on that or ask some more questions. Let me just illustrate that with a story. I was in Thailand a few months ago, And I was partnering, I'm president of an NGO called Tear Fund. And as president of an NGO, I was doing visiting some of our partners called Siam Care in the north, the Thai-Laos border. And Siam Care is a Christian organization. Tear Fund predominantly partners with Christian organizations. But the Christian organizations we believe and we trust are not just keeping the money, the funds, and the work to themselves, but they will be blessing the whole community, irrespective of their religious background. But we've partnered with these organizations a long time. We trust them. We've got a modus vivendi, and they get on with the work. Okay, so I was visiting Siam Care. A woman came to meet me from the airport and drove me to Siam Care's headquarters. I suddenly recognized the fact that this was kind of unusual. The car was full of Buddhas hanging from every kind of corner and so on. So I said, is this a hired car or is it your own? Trying to be kind of tactful. And she said, it's my car. So then I swallowed deeply and said, so you're a Buddhist? Yes, I'm a Buddhist, she said. So I'm thinking Buddhist. She's the team leader of a Christian organization. So then I said, are there other Buddhists who work for Siam Care? She said, yes. So I said, how many? 80% of us are Buddhist, she says. This is Thailand. Right, I said. She said, we're well qualified for the job. You know, we go into the communities, we help people who are HIV positive, we work with AIDS patients, and we're very qualified people. We do the job well. I said, wonderful, tremendous. Great. So I said, what's on our agenda this week? So she says, tomorrow morning we start with staff prayers. Then I kind of do a double take, thinking, I don't know anybody's prayers. What am I going to do? Because she said, you'll be leading staff prayers. You're the president of Tear Fund. So I'm apoplectic about this and struggling. What do I do with Buddhist prayers at this Christian organization? My mind's kind of going into overdrive. So I say, well, what happens at staff prayers? Well, she said, we read the Bible. I said, you read the Bible? Yes, she said, Siam Care is a Christian organization, she said. We read the Bible, and then we have prayers, and we sing some hymns. Fine, I said. So I agonizing all night. And she said, and you will be reading the Bible for us tomorrow. You will be explaining, because there are only two Christians, and they don't know that much about the Bible, and they've run out of passages. So the next morning I go, and I decide we will do the woman at the well, which is a Samaritan woman who Jesus finds at the well. She finds Jesus at the well, rather. She comes to the well at noonday, at a time when she knows other people are not going to be around. She's a much married woman. She's been divorced or abandoned or died upon 5 times, and now she's living with a bloke she's not married to. So a very riveting story. But I didn't tell the whole story. I focused on just one aspect of the woman at the well, and that was her question to Jesus. Look, I see you're a prophet, she says, when he reveals to her that he knows she's living with somebody she's not married to and so on. And she's always wanted to ask a prophet a question. Tell me, who's right, Samaritans or Jews? You Jews say we have to worship in the temple. We Samaritans say we can worship on this mountain. Which of us is right? And Jesus' answer is actually, I think, very profound. He says, look, the time is coming. In fact, it's already here, where it won't matter one bit where we worship. The location is totally and utterly irrelevant. What you have to realize is God is spirit, and those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. And what Jesus is doing is opening himself up as the avenue to worship God in spirit and in truth, and he does it with this woman at the well. So I tell the story to Ruth, and they're very, very happy with it, and we have some prayers. And then I say, and what's on the agenda now? And she says, well, now, because you're here, we're going to go around everybody who needs prayer, because I've told them the Christians are coming, and they can come and pray with you. And we do that, one person after another, after another, after another. The first is a little girl being brought up by her grandfather and great-grandmother. All the other generations have died from AIDS. And she is HIV positive. She has to go into hospital for blood transfusion. She's never left her grandfather. She's petrified. And she says, the Buddhist friend says, I will bring the Christians, and they will pray for you, and you will not be frightened when the Christians have prayed for you. And so she says, so you go, and the little girl will not be frightened when you've prayed. And this is a tall order, going into a community and praying so the little girl will not be frightened anymore. And so I say to the grandfather, is it time to pray? And he says, no, not yet, I must get the neighbours. So he goes and fetches all his neighbours. Everybody from all these mud huts comes sitting around, expectant, waiting for me to produce this miracle in this shaking, agonising, screaming child who doesn't want to go into hospital, through my prayer. I mean, it's scary stuff. So I pray, and the girl stops screaming and shaking, and she's quite happy. Yes, she says, I'm happy to go into hospital tomorrow. And I'm thinking, I have no idea what's going on here. Absolutely no idea whatsoever. But the whole of the day, in the next 2 days, is like that. And the final day for me, and this is really why I'm telling this story, was, I said, what's, and she said, the final one is not, he's not got HIV/AIDS, but he's a man who's going to die quite soon, and he's in hospital, and he is terrified of meeting his maker. He's not worshipped God during his life. He's been a bad man. He tells me he's been a very bad man. There are many things that he's done are very bad, and he wants forgiveness. And I have told him the Christians are coming, and they will show you how to get forgiveness. She says, I am a Buddhist. I can't really help you on this one, but I will bring the Christians. No, this is serious. So she took me there, and I prayed with this man. And first of all, the man's wife said, I don't think this is at all appropriate. And this is all in Thai, and it's been translated. I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think we can worship in this hospital. We need a temple. We need the proper arrangements and so on. And this girl intercedes and says, but no, we had staff prayers yesterday morning, and in the Bible it says it doesn't matter where we worship, because God is spirit, and we have to worship in spirit and truth. So we can worship in this hospital. We can worship in this board. It's fine. And so then she says to me, so get on with it. And I listen to the man, and it's very extraordinary. I mean, it's almost like being a Catholic priest. It is. It's like listening to a confession about what this man has done, being repeated and translated, and then just bringing the absolution of God through Christ to this man. And just simply saying, you may put your hand in the hand of God. You may receive the forgiveness that God has given you. You may, because Christ has died for you. And the whole ward was perfectly happy with that in this extraordinary way. And when a few days later I went back to the airport, I said, what kind of Buddhists are you, by the way? I've not met many Buddhists like you. and she said, well, I'm a Buddhist. I've been brought up a Buddhist. I will always be a Buddhist, because my parents would be very distressed if I became anything else. So I thought a bit more about this, and I said, at home I've got a friend who would call himself a Hindu follower of Christ. And she said, yes, yes, that's good. I would call myself a Buddhist follower of Christ. What does that mean? Well, for me, it meant inclusivism. It meant, actually, she had already found God through Christ in a different way, but she was still a Buddhist by all kind of intents and purposes from a cultural point of view. I haven't got the categories for making sense of that. I know God has, and that's really all that matters.
So you mentioned kind of various things in the Old Testament which suggest a pluralist position, like this call by Joshua to choose who you will serve, or the huge emphasis on justice, which is a concept that we very much associate with pluralism nowadays. But there's some passages in the Old Testament which really kind of seem to go against a pluralist point of view. So I'd just like to read a bit from the law that kind of God gave to the people. So it says, if your brother, the son of your mother, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend, who is as your own soul, entices you secretly, saying, let's go and serve other gods, which neither you nor your fathers have known, some of the gods of the peoples who are around you, whether near you or far off from you, from one end of the earth to the other, you shall not yield to him, or listen to him. Nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him, nor shall you conceal him, but you shall kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. Do you think this is compatible with a God who is in favour of pluralism?
Okay, the question for the recording
was to pull me up, really, on the whole issue of pluralism and the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, because I'd actually pinpointed some of the prophets and the Psalms where pluralism, and in the sense of being searched for justice, was heavily mentioned. But here we've had a different passage in the law, which is really focusing upon God as a jealous God, who will not give his glory to any other. And therefore, the instruction that when people are being lured away from this God to serve another God, which in biblical terms is always an idolatrous position, then the response is to kill that person and to take their life. I mean, I could give you a lot more passages. I find we could have a great time kind of wallowing in them all, because there are considerable passages in the Hebrew Scriptures that do pinpoint the incredible jealousy of God for his own glory and justice, but also for his own name. I mean, it even forms part of the Ten Commandments. You know, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And the whole idea of visiting the sins of the fathers, even unto the children of the third and fourth generation, sounds like a very punitive God. In fact, I don't think that is. This is an aside. But I think what's going on there is God recognizing that generational sin is passed down the line. And great-great-grandchildren will often be doing things that have been embedded in the family. So that's slightly a different issue. But what's going on here, I think, well, there are two things, really. One is the protection of the name of God and the vehement kind of declamation against idolatry. That whenever we make an idol of anything that exists that is not God, anything that God has made, then we are guilty of blasphemy at the highest order. And the prophets, whilst they're still pushing a pluralist kind of justice motif, are also pushing this at the same time. Isaiah pushes both. And Isaiah 45 spends a long time talking about the people who are bowing down to gods who cannot save and what a terrible waste of time it is. But this is more vehement than that, in that it suggests that life should be taken for that. I think all we can say is that this was part of a process that went on in the development of the Jewish faith in the Old Testament. It's not there all the way through. It's there at certain stages, but what we get, I think, in the Hebrew Scriptures is a developmental faith that begins to shape up and take much more shape and becomes quite different by the end of the Old Testament than from the beginning. For example, the concept of God changes. So at one part of the Old Testament, the concept of God is that this is just a tribal deity who will beat other tribal deities. So, but he's our tribal deity, henotheism. And that is quite an intrinsic and deep part of some of the Old Testament reading of God. But by the time you get to the prophets, and certainly by the time you get to the New Testament, that's gone completely. God is now the God of the whole world. He's not even just the God of the Jews. He's also the God of the Gentiles. He is the God of justice. He is the universal, sovereign God. So I think that this is one of those developmental motifs, and it's one that says, okay, when we see God in this way, then we have to actually enact vengeance on his name. But later, in fact, very often, we are told that we mustn't take a life of anybody for any reason, because it's not ours to take. And you have to square that with those passages that that are calling for blood in that respect. There was another question somewhere else. Oh, yes.
Thank you very much for talk. I just wanted to know if I could get a comment on the history of Christianity, which hasn't always been possible for pluralism.
Yes, question about the history of Christianity, which always hasn't fostered pluralism. You can say that again. I mean, our history is as bad as anybody else's, and I think that in many ways it's very easy to point the finger at something that we now call Christendom, and look at the way in which we got it terribly wrong in the past. I mean, we got it wrong, systematically right across the board. I mean, the Crusades were horrendous, and an awful lot of the issues that Christians fought each other over and went to the stake for and burnt each other over were horrendous. But if you look at them very carefully, what you see there is a politicization of Christianity. You never see the real thing. And what mars Christian history is the way in which political power somehow annexed and captured Christianity, not in total, but the trappings and the structures, and made them their own. And so what you got is a bastardization. This isn't true Christianity. I mean, look at what happens to the cross, the cross itself. The cross is a symbol on which Christ died. Christ gave his life for the whole of humanity, so that those who believe can actually receive forgiveness through him. But the cross became the symbol that we took into war, not the symbol on which the Saviour died. So the cross is actually, the real meaning of the cross is it's where God empties himself of all power and becomes powerless for the sake of the world. But the cross was the banner that was taken into the Crusades and into wars, the thing that we went behind in order to exterminate other people. So there's so many ways in which not just the teachings of Christianity, but the symbols of Christianity and the trappings of Christianity were changed by political power, politicizing, by annexing and misunderstanding. I think the counter to that is always to go back to the New Testament. There is absolutely nothing in the New Testament that justifies any of that behavior or any of that activity. And over again, Jesus is rebuking his own disciples for politicizing, for warmongering, for wanting to lord it over the others and not for servant leadership. And I think if we grasp the central point of Christ is that the Son of God gave his life that others might live, became a servant rather than became obsessed with personal power. So anything at any stage in any era which presents Christianity as power obsessed or as full of control freaks, we have to resist it. But we have to resist it in the name of Christianity and not in the name of secularism, because that's where it really is resisted.
I'll take one more question. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask.
Why don't we you go first, ask your question, and we'll take the second question together and then the last one.
Okay, I was just going to ask, following on to what you just said, what is the dynamic between the cross as a model for God in public and Christ as king, Christ as the ascended and enthroned king of all? And how would you play out that dynamic in a Christian idea of religion in the public sphere?
My question has quite a different focus, actually, from some of the others. My question really is that since, as Christians, we believe that God's laws reflect his good and his holy character, and those laws are therefore like for our benefit, are beneficial to us, for us to keep. How far and to what extent should, as Christians, should we be campaigning for our national laws and policies to reflect the moral and ethical convictions that we hold as Christians based on God's law given because of his good and holy character?
The second one first, and that is God's laws are good, and we believe as Christians and believers that they are holy in character and they're beneficial for us. So to what extent should we be pushing for our national laws and policies to reflect the ethical and moral basis of God's laws? I think totally. I mean, I have no qualms about this at all, because they're not private laws for a few people to keep in their own their own walk of faith before God. They are public laws. They were given in a public arena. They were given for public societies. People often say, well, they were given in an idealistic world, but actually in a really sinful world, we can't live like that. That's nonsense. I mean, they were given to sinners from the very beginning, sinners who didn't know how to live together. And society then was just as deranged and depraved as our own. So I think that we should be pushing very hard for us to have those laws that reflect God's provision and God's blessings on humankind. But then the big question is, what laws are we talking about? And I think that we are talking about laws that bless everyone. We are talking about laws of protection for the vulnerable. Those are very, very important laws, and there are many of those in the New Testament and the Old Testament. We are talking against the laws of usury, and for that we would include gambling and casinos, and we would include all the kinds of things that actually harm the vulnerable and capture people and put people into bondage. And I think if we can have laws protecting people who are more easily put into bondage, that again reflects some of the things that God is making provisions for in his law. And then laws of faithfulness, and we should honour marriage, and I think our marriage laws have, until fairly recently, honoured the institution of marriage and call people to live faithful lives with each other, that we're not betray each other, that marriage is that kind of institution where we can find safety and peace and rest and an echo of ourselves, but also where we can give ourselves to another, not fearing the consequences, because we're protected legally as well. And so any diminution in the And the marriage laws I would want to oppose, because I think marriage is an institution that we need to keep, and we're losing fast on this one, and layers of others. So we must I think, push very heavily for that, and I think we have got a good set of laws. I think we're very privileged in this country that much of our legal basis has been not profoundly based on scripture, but not a million miles off some of the things that we've seen there. Equality before the law, equality of the courts. I think where it starts to get murky is where we have people with power and money and so on who are able to exercise special privileges. But to restrain all of those is very important. But we also have to have the laws which are merciful to those who live differently. And I think that's to those who, you know, in a sense, end up divorced, to those who are struggling with being sinned against. So laws of mercy as well as laws of justice are vital. The final question then about how do we reconcile the cross as God's self-giving with Christ the King and Christ the Victor. And I think that for Christians, Christ the King is a very powerful motif. And Christ the King in several different ways. Christ the one who actually subverts the very meaning of kingdoms and of kings. When Jesus is given the title of King, it's interesting when he talks about the kingdom of God in the New Testament, the kingdom of God of which he is the King, it's against the backcloth of the Romans and the Herodians and all of the kings that were around at the time, and in stark contrast to those. I mean, those kings were pretty ghastly, and kings through the ages have been pretty ghastly. You know, they've been ruthless, they've been despotic. Ivan was terrible. You know, Idi Amin was absolutely ghastly. And you've got Pol Pot and all of these rulers that have just been the very antipathy of what Christ's king is about. So at the one hand, what we get is a very different view of kingship and a very, very different view of authority. And we have to hang on to that in our worldly realm, in our political realm. Christ as King means something today in politics. Read my husband's book, Jesus and Politics, because he's got a whole chapter outlining this. What does it mean for Christ to be King in the political arena today? And it doesn't mean that we privilege Christians. It doesn't mean that we, you know, allow Christianity more special privileges over against other religions. No, it means that we look at the way in which Christ was King and try to model and reflect that in our own policies and what we do in the public arena. But the second thing, the cross is self. The second thing about Christ being King is that it is an eschatological vision. So the ultimate aspect of Christ being King will not be realized on this world and on this earth, never, because whatever kings we have, they will always be frail and faulty in the light of Christ's kingship.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.